Welcome to Breast Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Eric Weiner from the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston, and to begin, he discussed a 57-year-old patient from his practice.
So this is a 57-year-old woman who presented with de novo metastatic ER-positive disease to breast and bone in 2014. She initially participated in the randomized trial of letrozole with and without ribo and had essentially no side effects other than those one would expect with letrozole. And I must tell you, I assumed, but I don't know for a fact, that she received the placebo. She had an initial response followed by stable disease for a number of months. But a little more than a year later, she developed disease progression. And at that point, thinking that she had not had a CDK4/6 inhibitor, and with the availability of palbociclib, she went on to receive fulvestrant and palbociclib, had a response in her breast, stable disease in her bone, and was on therapy for just under 2 years, for 22 months.
Could I just ask you, it seems like it would have been nice to know whether she got the ribo or not. I didn't think that trials prevent you from learning that.
So the trials do really prevent you from learning that. You can unblind if there's a medical emergency. But in this case, there was no emergency. I had the ability to give her palbo, and in truth, I was really pretty convinced that she had not received anything other than a placebo. Her blood counts never budged. She had absolutely no other side effects, and so I was reasonably confident.
As long as you're bringing that up, from your point of view, and I don't know how much clinical experience you have with the three CDK inhibitors, obviously there's been a tremendous amount of research coming out of your place, but from what your own experience in the clinical literature, is there any way to differentiate the tolerability toxicity profile of ribo versus palbo?
Not really. Ribo, at least from a symptomatic standpoint, is essentially the same. It causes a decrease in blood counts. The one added piece about ribo, or two, is that it can cause abnormal liver function tests and has been associated with QT prolongation. So practically, it's just a bit more challenging to use than palbo, which is why I think most people typically use palbo.
Although I have heard people say, and I'm not sure exactly why, that there may be some practical benefits of ribo in the packaging or the voucher system or anything like that?
It's nothing that I've been able to perceive.
Right, okay.
So for me, and I'm not saying for a moment that ribo is a bad drug, it's a fine drug, but I would typically use palbo in place of ribo. And I think of abema as a drug with a different side effect profile.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that because then I see, interestingly, that she went on abema by itself. Was that on a trial?
That was not on a trial. That was based on the single agent approval. The truth is, we don't know if CDK4/6 inhibition after CDK4/6 inhibition is useful, whether switching drugs is useful. At that point in time, she didn't have a lot of symptoms, and I felt like we could try something. The official approval for abema, single agent abema, as per the FDA, does not address the issue of prior CDK4/6 inhibition. So in fact, it is approved whether or not you've had it.
And you said that you think you can tell if somebody's been on ribo or palbo. How about abema?
In terms of side effects?
Yeah, in terms of side effects. Obviously,
well, abema, it's usually not a secret to the doctor or patient when somebody's on abema because it does cause diarrhea. Doesn't cause a lot of myelosuppression or not as much as we see with palbo or ribo, but it pretty frequently causes diarrhea, and that's something you have to be watchful. And I want to make this point, and it's actually one of the reasons I chose this case. I don't think that CDK4/6 inhibition after a patient has progressed on a CDK4/6 inhibitor is at this point in time a therapy that everyone should get. I think in this case, the choice was moving on to chemotherapy, giving another hormonal agent either by itself or possibly with an mTOR inhibitor, or trying something like Abema, and I decided to try the Abema. But I'm not suggesting for a second that that was the only choice or that's something that has to be done in all patients.
I think that's a really good point. Just to finish out, though, in terms of tolerability, how often do you give Abema and there are like zero problems, no GI, nothing?
Not often.
How often do you give it where the GI problems are enough of a problem that you have to hold it or reduce the dose?
30 to 50% of the time.
Interesting.
I mean, it's pretty common to have to reduce the dose, oftentimes after a hold.
And what about just having to discontinue it? And I ask you for all three drugs.
So it's pretty rare to have to discontinue either palbo or ribo. I have had it happen, although in the metastatic setting, it doesn't commonly happen. Where I saw it happen a little bit more is in patients who were in our adjuvant pilot, where women with high risk stage 2 and 3 ER positive breast cancer all received hormonal therapy plus palbo. And in that setting where it felt that much more elective to the patient, a small number of side effects would sometimes lead to discontinuation. In terms of Abema, I can think of a couple of patients where I've ultimately had to discontinue, although in truth, most of the time it's been tolerable with some dose reduction or modification.
So you mentioned everolimus as an option. For example, in this patient, I see that unfortunately after she progressed on the Abema, she had symptomatic leptomeningeal disease. I want to hear about that. But if she just had had progression and was clinically stable, what do you think would be your next choice?
I think I would have either given her exemestane and everolimus or tamoxifen and everolimus.
And just out of curiosity, what are you doing right now in terms of preemptive medications when you use everolimus in terms of mucositis, and what ends up being the bottom line?
Yeah, well, so I will confess that I was a relatively late adopter in terms of prophylactic steroid mouthwash. Maybe that's partially because I have tended not to give everolimus all that much, but my sense is that it's quite effective, and that you can really reduce the incidence and severity of mucositis with that approach, and it does make it more tolerable.
I personally feel that, you know, there was so much focus on that mucositis that a lot of people didn't really realize how effective everolimus is. I mean, the hazard rates are pretty good.
Hazard rates are pretty good. No survival advantage, but then there's no survival advantage to date with the CDK4/6 inhibitors as well. No, I agree with you. It has not been a drug that, at least from my standpoint and in my clinical practice, has been a popular drug. But I think that now that we can minimize the mucositis, I think we can think about using it more.
So what happened with this lady that she developed leptomeningeal disease? She had symptoms?
Oh, my gosh. This was unexpected. This is somebody with lobular cancer, and so lobular cancer does have a slightly higher propensity to metastasize to the leptomeninges. But, you know, it's pretty uncommon to see leptomeningeal disease in someone who isn't heavily pretreated with prior chemotherapy. I mean, she's only had endocrine therapy and CDK4/6 inhibitors. And she developed headaches. She had a lot of sort of funny neurologic symptoms. And within a couple of weeks, it became clear to us that this needed further evaluation. I have to tell you that at first, I was not in a rush based on the characteristics of her headaches to start working it up. But lo and behold, she had very clear-cut leptomeningeal disease on MRI, which was confirmed with an LP. And, you know, at that point in time, she had never received any chemotherapy before. Capecitabine is a drug that does penetrate the CNS pretty well. And the radiotherapy options, in my mind, were not great because she really had diffuse changes, so it would have involved a lot of radiation. And so I elected to put her on capecitabine, and she's actually had a great response to it.
When you say she's had a great response, is that just clinically or imaging-wise?
So she's had repeat imaging, which has shown a small degree of improvement, but it's the symptomatic improvement that's most dramatic. Her headaches went away. She was having a lot of nausea. It went away. And she's really feeling fine. I actually went last night to a fashion show of vintage clothing that was put on as a fundraiser for metastatic breast cancer, and she modeled in the fashion show.
Wow. Wow. So she's had no radiation therapy, though.
She has not had radiation. Radiation, you know, if she develops a site that is particularly symptomatic, radiation will be the next approach.
And what are you thinking if you need, which I guess is not unlikely, another systemic therapy, particularly one with CNS activity, if possible? What would you be thinking about, or any experimental things you might be thinking about?
Yeah. You know, so most of the drugs we have in the context of a disrupted blood-brain barrier do get in to some degree. So I would potentially think about any agent. High up on the list would be something which does appear to penetrate the CNS. I've never been a big fan of using drugs like carboplatin in ER-positive disease, but carboplatin gets in. I think we're just going to have to see how it goes. There are very few trials, especially in the HER2-negative setting, for patients with leptomeningeal disease, so I'm not sure a trial will be an option.
Interesting. I want to kind of go back through her case and pick up on a few points. The first was her initial therapy, and you suspect that she actually only got endocrine therapy. First of all, I wanted to ask you, outside a trial setting, of course, now it's a lot later, and a lot of time's going on since that trial started, of course, but nowadays, are there any clinical situations where you think about using just endocrine therapy alone with the metastatic disease without a CDK inhibitor?
Well, so until there's a survival advantage with the CDK4/6 inhibitors, my feeling is that when you use them is an option, not a mandate. That said, most of the time, I tend to use it up front. But in a patient who may be particularly sensitive to the side effects of CDK4/6 inhibition, a patient who I would expect perhaps might be on endocrine therapy for a long time, you know, so a woman who presented 15 years ago, got 5 years of tamoxifen, never had any other therapy, presents with asymptomatic metastatic disease with a relatively low burden of disease, that's somebody who I might think about using endocrine therapy alone. I don't know that CDK4/6 inhibitors are any less effective in her than in someone else, but I think she might get reasonable mileage out of endocrine therapy alone, and I can use the CDK4/6 inhibitor with second-line therapy. But the truth is most of the patients typically get it up front.
What about choice of endocrine therapy in the upfront setting? There have been trials. I think they're kind of before CDK, comparing endocrine strategies, fulvestrant to an AI, I think to the combination. Anything there that, you know, gets you excited?
In terms of endocrine therapy, I typically don't use a combination of an AI and fulvestrant. It, you know, in one trial did appear to be better than the AI alone. There have been recent trials, as you know, suggesting that fulvestrant might be better than an AI. The problem there is that if you talk to patients, in the absence of a survival advantage, most people would prefer to avoid having a parenteral drug that involves getting a shot in each buttocks every month. And although the patients don't complain to me about it, they complain to our nurses about it.
Actually, I don't know why, it just kind of floated into my mind that an oncologist recently brought up the question of fulvestrant in patients who are anticoagulated in terms of the injections. Have you used it with anticoagulations? Have you seen problems?
In that situation, you know, I'm a little less inclined to use it. I have used it in that situation. I haven't seen any problems, but it is an IM injection. There is the potential for bleeding. And, you know, it makes me a little anxious.
So one of the big questions of the day is, how do you select between the three CDK inhibitors? Everybody has their own formula, but it seems to kind of circle around toxicity and schedule from what I'm hearing. I haven't heard anybody say they think there's a difference in efficacy, although I've heard people say that about Abema, that they think maybe it's more potent, that they like the continuous dosing biologically. From your point of view, and your colleague, you know, Hal Burstein has this slide where he says, I know I'm not supposed to do this, but he puts the hazard ratios of these drugs up there. Can you pull out a difference or even inkling?
No. So I think they're, you know, in terms of clinical results, they're all about the same. There's an occasional patient that you don't want to make potentially neutropenic where you would use Abema. But the truth is the diarrhea tends to be more bothersome to patients than asymptomatic neutropenia. I think many of us have this sense that Abema should be the best drug, but it hasn't been shown to be the best drug. And so for the most part, I use Palbo in an upfront setting. If for some reason I want to emphasize CNS penetration, I'm a little bit more likely to use Abema because it's shown some activity in the CNS. But, you know, I don't think we have a final answer here.
You said in terms of best drug, but I've also heard people bring up the schedule sort of. Actually, Joyce O'Shaughnessy is on the same program that you are, and she doesn't like the idea of them going without the drug and the possibility, even though it's maybe you don't see it in clinical data, of, you know, letting the tumor grow for a week or so.
Yeah, you know, I think it's fine to have those ideas and to use that as a scientific hypothesis and ask a question either in the laboratory or in the context of a trial to address it. But clinically, I don't know that it makes a difference going off for a week. And so I tend to save those kinds of observations for designing future research, not for dictating my clinical practice.
I'm flashing on a lot of cases that I've heard presented of patients where various issues have come up. I remember one of a patient with persistent neutropenia. I think it was with Palbo, and the patient had radiation therapy recently. How do you factor in concurrent or recent radiation therapy in terms of the concern about the marrow?
So I don't give CDK4/6 inhibitors concurrently with radiation. I stop it during the radiation. You know, most radiation doesn't cause a huge impact on blood counts. Occasionally, if you have a big field, it does, and that would be a situation where I might favor Abema.
And what about monitoring in terms of white counts or CBCs? First of all, do you monitor the same for all three?
I worry about it less for Abema. I typically get a count, you know, somewhere during cycle one, but it's usually not a problem. And once we get beyond cycle one, if it looks like the blood counts are not getting terribly low, I don't get too hung up on monitoring in between visits.
Yeah, that was another thing I've heard a number of people question about, sort of the mechanics of what you do based on what the white count is. You know, once it gets into the, you know, 1.2, 1.3 absolute neutrophil counts, any sort of practical advice about sort of how to do this?
Well, so I think 1.2 absolute neutrophils is just fine. People don't get into trouble there. For that matter, it's the rare patient who gets into any trouble with a neutrophil count of 500. You know, it's when it's really low that it's a problem, or when it's really low in conjunction with some GI insult. So I tend to dose reduce if people, now I'm really talking about with Palbo, if patients are consistently coming back with absolute neutrophil counts less than 1,000, particularly when it's heading down towards 500. But for example, if I had had somebody who had been stable on a full dose of Palbo for the past 6 months, came in for a visit and had 950 granulocytes, I wouldn't feel compelled to dose reduce them that cycle. I'd monitor it again and see if it's going down.
So, of course, one of the big questions here is CDK inhibition in the earlier stage setting, post-neoadjuvant, adjuvant, locally advanced. First of all, are there any situations right now, super, super high risk, multiple nodes, a lot of residual disease after neoadjuvant therapy where you would, in a, if you could get it paid for, use the CDK inhibitor off trial?
Generally speaking, no. The one exception I can come up with is, for example, I saw a woman last week who had had an ER-positive breast cancer 11 years ago, developed recurrent disease to her axilla, had two positive lymph nodes on a lymph node dissection that is still ER-positive breast cancer, which is what you would have expected. So she has nodal disease only. It's a nodal recurrence. And she is someone who I suppose one could argue to give chemotherapy to, although the KLOR data could be used to say that chemotherapy isn't terribly effective in that setting in somebody with ER-positive disease. And beyond that, she was not having chemotherapy for a second and had no interest in receiving it. And she's somebody with recurrent disease to the axilla where I would consider giving a couple of year course of a CDK4/6 inhibitor with endocrine therapy. But I can't tell you with certainty that, with any certainty whatsoever, that that's better than just using endocrine therapy.
So I feel like almost every possible clinical situation flies by my face through cases that I try to remember. But I know we had a case recently of a patient who really wanted to have breast conservation, and the surgeon was just not happy. They felt like he was not going to get a good cosmetic result. And the doc actually did an Oncotype, and it was low. Actually gave her endocrine therapy, and she ended up responding. But I wonder, again, in a case like that, if you could get it paid for, would it make sense?
I certainly don't think it would be immoral to do it. We have a trial doing just that, although it's a randomized trial.
Really?
So half of the patients get endocrine therapy alone, half get endocrine therapy plus a CDK4/6 inhibitor.
Neoadjuvantly.
Neoadjuvantly.
Wow, awesome.
I think the one thing you can say about it is that it doesn't necessarily require a prolonged course of CDK4/6 inhibition. You'd probably do it for 4 to 6 months. So it's not committing someone to years of therapy necessarily if your real goal is breast conservation. But outside of a trial, I'd be somewhat loath to do it.
I don't know how many people have been on the trial, but any sense yet about whether PathCR might increase?
I think it's probably unlikely that there's going to be a big difference in PathCR. Whether or not there's a difference in breast conservation rate or response or KS67, I think, remains to be seen. The hard thing about these low oncotype tumors is that they're probably not responsive to chemotherapy in the neoadjuvant setting. They're responsive to endocrine therapy, but you don't see a PathCR, and particularly for patients who have very large tumors, you often still are not in a position where you can do breast conservation. That said, we know from the trial that Matt Ellis ran now over a decade ago, in which tamoxifen and letrozole were compared in the neoadjuvant setting in postmenopausal women, that the breast conservation rate, even without PathCR, because there were very few PathCRs in that trial, was substantially higher with letrozole than with tamoxifen. And it was not unrespectable. These were patients who were thought not to be candidates for breast conservation. And if I remember right, about half of them actually became candidates.
Very interesting. So kind of curious, any guess? I mean, it seems like we never really know. Sometimes we get big surprises, but certainly the day that we start hearing about these adjuvant or neoadjuvant trials potentially could be really a major change in clinical practice in many different points of view, including financial, actually.
My thought, exactly.
Any rough estimate is a couple years? When do you think the earliest is we're going to see any of this?
So I think the first trial, the first definitive trial that'll read out will be PALLAS, which is the trial that Erica Mayer is running along with Angie DeMichel and Michael Ganant. And that trial is going to close to accrual, having enrolled over 5,000 patients in a couple of years. So in about 2 months, it's going to close to accrual. And I don't remember the specifics of the statistical design, but I think that it's pretty likely we're going to have an answer within a couple of years.
Just out of curiosity, what fraction of these patients do you think got some kind of genomic assay or oncotype?
I think, sadly, probably a minority, because these are mostly with a few exceptions, or not few, but I think less than 20% of the population had node negative disease. One of the investigators had pushed strongly for including some patients with T2 and 0 disease. I think some of those patients probably had an oncotype. I think most of the node positive patients probably didn't. And later on, maybe we'll have an opportunity to talk about the role of oncotype and other genomic assays in node positive disease.
Well, I was just thinking that, you know, if you had those data, would it be interesting? I kind of think it might be.
I think it would be very interesting. And I think that one potential option, because blocks are being collected on all
Absolutely.
These patients, will be to do it afterwards.
So one more question. We could go on this topic, which is great because there used to be nothing to talk about. But I know there are trials out there in the metastatic setting looking at triplets, the idea mTOR, CDK, and hormones. And I kind of like that idea. We're oncologists. We love to add stuff. When are we going to find out about that, or what do we know about it right now?
Well, I think what we know about it right now is that it's a not non-toxic combination.
Really? More so than individually?
Yeah.
Really?
I mean, it's a pretty tough combination.
Huh.
And we'll have to see. I mean, maybe it'll turn out to be more efficacious. I don't know when we're going to really get a definitive answer there.
So more what? More mucositis or what?
More mucositis, a fair amount of myelosuppression, and maybe that's just the patients who I've treated on these regimens. But I don't think it's for the faint of heart.
Interesting. So you mentioned genomic assays, and of course at the ASCO meeting, we saw the big plenary presentation of the Taylor X study. I wanted to get your take on that. But just to sort of get into that, I wanted you to present a patient where you used the genomic assay, and you have this 60-year-old lady. What happened there?
Okay. So 60-year-old woman, 2.3-centimeter, ER-positive, moderately differentiated tumor. Sentinel node biopsy revealed 1 out of 3 nodes that were positive that had a 0.6-centimeter focus of disease. No symptoms of metastatic disease, as you would expect. Oncotype was sent and was 20, and the patient was started on adjuvant endocrine therapy.
So, of course, this introduces the question of using genomic assays in node-positive disease, a practice that I think is still not particularly supported by the ASCO guideline, or unless they change that. Did they?
Well, let's just hope they change that. I think that at some point NCCN may support that approach.
Well, I'm actually interviewing Dan Hayes, so I'll see what
he'll disagree with me, so that's fine.
Totally. I know. I put that in an education email once, and he sent me this long, you know, response. I read your thing, whatever. Anyhow.
So here's my take on it, okay? So first, let's talk for a minute about Taylor X. Taylor X was a well-done study. No study is perfect. The inclusion criteria were a little different from what I might have envisioned. Personally, I would have included women with 1 to 3 nodes in that study. And I pushed to amend the study to include those patients.
Really? Wow.
At one point in time.
Seems like that had been a lot easier than launching a whole other study or expander.
That was my point of view. But in any case, it didn't happen. But the results as we have them, I think, are pretty clear for most of the patients. And certainly for all patients with recurrence scores of less than 16, there is absolutely no value in terms of adding chemotherapy. I would actually extend that into recurrence scores up to 20 in all patients, pre and post. The difference in the subset analysis in premenopausal women who had recurrence scores of between 16 and 20 was extremely small in terms of distant recurrences. And of course, much of the benefit from any chemotherapy in that group of women could easily have been from ovarian suppression. In postmenopausal women, I think it is clear-cut that having a recurrence score through 25 is associated with no benefit from chemotherapy. And in that same group of women, we don't know what's going on in the high 20s either. None of the studies have addressed that. And I think that the only question in my mind for a woman who's postmenopausal and node negative is in that 26 to 30 range, and I don't know if chemotherapy works or not because it hasn't been studied prospectively. in premenopausal women with scores on the high end of the range, 21 to 25, there did appear to be some benefit from chemotherapy, and a benefit, at least in absolute terms, that was large enough that you can't ignore it. I don't know how much of that is from ovarian suppression. I worry that this is a subset of a subset, and we have to be careful there. But I do think that chemotherapy question is an open question in premenopausal women with scores of 21 to 25. Now, what about node-positive patients?
Before you get off node-negative, could I just ask you if you kind of put what you just said together, would you say that for the postmenopausal patient, node-negative patient, the new intermediate, so to speak, is 25 to 30?
Yeah, or technically 26 to 30, but yes. I think it's clear cut for 25 and less, no chemo.
And then for premenopausal patient, is the new intermediate 16 to 20?
So I think the new intermediate is probably 21 to 25, because I think there are still questions there.
Oh, interesting.
You know, look, I don't think anyone's wrong to give 42-year-old woman with high-grade cancer and an oncotype of 18 chemotherapy. But I think in general, with scores of 20 or less, you can forget chemotherapy in all women.
So getting back to your patient, did you know the TAILOR-X results when you made the decision on her?
I did.
So I guess my question is, if she were premenopausal and she had one positive node and an oncotype of 20, same woman, same situation, but premenopausal, what would you have done?
I'd have a different discussion with her. And in that setting, I'd really go through what we know, what we don't know, emphasize, as I would in this patient as well, that the study did not include women who had positive lymph nodes. In that setting, I would have a somewhat lower threshold for using chemotherapy, although even there, I suspect that the benefit is going to be pretty darn small. And, you know, 20 is still within the range in the node negative setting where I typically wouldn't give chemotherapy, particularly to somebody who's got a moderately differentiated, let's say, ER and PR positive cancer. And so I would talk to her. I wouldn't feel badly about giving her chemotherapy. I wouldn't feel badly about not giving her chemotherapy. If I didn't give her chemotherapy, I clearly would give her ovarian suppression.
But, you know, it's interesting as I listen to you, and I guess it's sort of obvious, but I don't know why, because other people have said the same thing to me since ASCO, but just now as you're talking about it, I realize that you're kind of applying the TAILOR-X numbers to node-positive patients, or at least this patient with one node.
Yep, you bet.
And so, in other words, I guess what we've heard prior to this, and you were about to go into the issue of node positive, but I know from having done so many surveys on investigators that the closer you get to one node, the more they are to use it and treat them like a node negative. The closer it gets to three nodes, the less likely, and after three, they're not doing it. But it sounds like now you've taken that whole paradigm and brought TAILOR-X numbers in it.
I think that's pretty much true. I mean, I don't know of a single situation where results in the node negative setting don't apply in the node positive setting, particularly in patients who have a limited amount of nodal involvement. Having one positive lymph node is just a little worse prognostically than having no lymph node involvement. And the same factors that predict hormonal therapy benefit, chemotherapy benefit in node-negative patients typically predict them in node-positive patients. Yes, you could say that the standard at this moment in time, if you're relying on oncotype, is to only apply it to node-negative patients, and we would have to wait. My fear is that that may be after I'm no longer a practicing oncologist, or maybe after I'm no longer alive, since I think it's going to take quite some time to get an answer. The other thing is that, you know, the ASCO guidelines actually endorse using MammaPrint in this setting. That's based on a relatively small randomized experience in patients with node-positive disease using MammaPrint in MINDACT. And I'm actually more comfortable extrapolating the TAILOR-X data, which I think are really, really robust data. I'm more comfortable extrapolating those data from node-positive to this woman with one positive lymph node than I even am accepting the results of MINDACT. Not that I doubt MINDACT, but it's a much smaller experience. So here, for me, this was pretty straightforward. I certainly explained to this woman that there are people who would give her chemotherapy, that we don't know for certain what the benefit is of chemotherapy in a woman who has lymph node positive disease, but I'm pretty confident as a clinician that her benefit from getting chemotherapy is going to be somewhere between zero and the very low single digits, and I just don't know how low.
Can you talk a little bit about other genomic assays? You mentioned MammaPrint. I'm curious, there's EndoPredict. I'd like to know what you think of it. There was a paper, I think it was in JAMA Oncology, comparing six different assays. Can you sort of summarize what we know? It kind of, in the past, it seems like theoretically that if you sent the same specimen for six different assays, it wasn't that clear to me that you necessarily get the same answers.
You don't always get the same answer. But nonetheless, you know, all of the assays are probably reasonable. I think we have the best data with Oncotype, and that's just because it was the first on the market and it's been so widely used, particularly in the United States. MammaPrint, I personally find a little more frustrating to use because rather than giving me the whole scale, it gives me sort of a yes, no answer. I realize that it does show you a diagram where you can see where your patient's tumor falls. But I don't really want the test to tell me give or don't give chemotherapy. I want to use that as a piece of information that I incorporate into all of my, into my decision-making, looking at all the other features as well. And again, you know, the number of patients in the group of women who were randomized to chemotherapy versus not because they had a low genomic risk and a high clinical risk was a pretty small number.
So I want to go on and talk a little bit about HER2-positive disease, and I want to ask you about this 56-year-old lady with metastatic disease. But before you talk about her, I wonder if you could update us on where we are with the paclitaxel trastuzumab adjuvant regimen.
Oh, sure.
We had a working group of oncologists recently on breast cancer, and we were chatting about what were some of the questions that they were most interested in hearing investigators and discussed. And a lot of them were about this, and particularly about the issue of how big the tumor can be, what kinds of tumors. It's clear, I think, to everybody now that this is a much better tolerated regimen. People want to use it, but they're getting kind of nervous based particularly on tumor size. Can you talk a little bit, first of all, about where you are with the data, anything new with that, and also kind of what the sizes were of the tumors, the patients that have been studied, and how that translates into practice?
Sure. So as you know, we essentially enrolled 400 patients who had node-negative disease into the prospective TH study, 12 weeks of paclitaxel and a year of trastuzumab. In terms of the patient population, about 50% of the patients had tumors less than a centimeter. Most of those had tumors that were T1B, but there were somewhere in the range of 18 or 19% of patients in the overall trial who had T1A tumors. The other half of the patients had tumors that were between 1.1 and 3 centimeters in size. 4/5 of those patients had tumors that were between 1.1 and 2. So from our standpoint, I think that this is a result that we feel comfortable applying in the stage 1 setting. I think there were few enough patients with tumors that were between 2 and 3 centimeters that I wouldn't pretend to say that you can directly apply these results to those patients. When we looked at the patients who had recurrences, there was really no difference based on tumor size in this study. But remember, we didn't have very many recurrences. Through now 7 years of follow-up, we're still talking about distant recurrences that are in the single digits. And although the disease-free survival, which takes into account all possible endpoints, is now 93% or thereabouts, the recurrence-free interval, which includes local regional recurrence, death from breast cancer, and distant recurrence, is still in the range of 97%. So I think this is a regimen that can be pretty broadly applied to patients with stage 1 HER2-positive disease. But I do want to emphasize that that doesn't mean that we have to give it to everyone. We don't necessarily have to give it to all patients with T1A tumors or maybe even the majority of those patients. And, you know, if someone has a patient who has multiple adverse features, let's say she has a 2-centimeter cancer, so on the far upper end of stage 1 disease, and there's diffuse lymphovascular invasion, and it's ER and PR negative, which at least in terms of early recurrence increases the risk. And if a doctor wants to give something other than TH, I think that's fine. I just think that for most patients, this is probably the regimen that makes most sense.
So, you know, I think this study really was very important in terms of, you know, what you did. The fact that it was one arm, you got a quick answer, had this great effect for people, really a cool situation in oncology, not just breast cancer. But I'm just kind of curious, if you could have done a phase 3 trial comparing TCH to paclitaxel trastuzumab across the board, big node negative, node positive, you name it, what do you think you would see?
Okay, so now we're totally into Eric bias.
Right.
Okay. And my opinion, I think we would have seen essentially identical results between the two regimens. I think it's very unlikely, you know, I'm not convinced that carboplatin adds to docetaxel in HER2-positive disease. Certainly in the metastatic setting, the trial that compared the two regimens, albeit with a slightly different dose of docetaxel, didn't show any added benefit for the carboplatin. And I think a taxane is a taxane. So if there were a difference, I think it's going to be a very small difference. I think it is possible, if not likely, that the anthracyclines probably do independently add just a little bit, but I suspect it's a very small addition as well. And I'll go on to say that I think that if one had been using a regimen like TH and then randomized to pertuzumab or not, we might have seen a slightly greater benefit for pertuzumab. Because when you give a little less chemotherapy, there may be more room for the biologic therapy to work.
Any thoughts about the combination of paclitaxel, trastuzumab, and pertuzumab, either in the neoadjuvant or adjuvant setting?
Well, so we are doing a pilot of THP in the neoadjuvant setting in patients with stage 2 and 3 disease with the plan that those patients who have a pathologic complete response, and we anticipate that'll be somewhere between 40 and 50%, will then be offered the opportunity of going on and receiving antibodies alone and no chemotherapy. That is intended as a pilot before undertaking a large national trial that is essentially going to do the same thing. And that trial, which is being led by ECOG Akron and the Alliance, is going to take patients with stage 2 and 3 disease, those patients who after THP have a pathologic complete response will be followed with antibody therapy alone. Those patients who have residual disease, who are therefore at higher risk of a recurrence, are going to be randomized to a standard treatment or a standard treatment plus something else.
Do you think that the interest in neoadjuvant therapy for HER2-positive tumors, particularly in the lower end size, you know, like around 2 centimeters, has diminished in recent years with the results of the AFFINITY trial that kind of weren't maybe as much as we would like, but also because I've heard people say this, because of the paclitaxel trastuzumab regimen, that if they give the neoadjuvant therapy, now they're committing to the TCHP, whereas if they let the patient go to surgery, maybe they'll be able to get away with just paclitaxel.
So I think that's the case for somebody with a 1.5 centimeter tumor. If you start talking about patients with a 2, 2.5, 3 centimeter tumor, I think you can argue that those patients aren't really appropriate outside of a trial for TH alone. And so there, I'd say, give your neoadjuvant therapy.
And I mean, everybody now has obviously lots of experience with various adjuvant regimens, including the paclitaxel trastuzumab regimen. I get the sense in talking to people, there's a pretty substantial difference in toxicity and tolerability that, I don't know, in your own mind, when you use TCHP, what you think the likelihood is that the patient's going to have enough of a problem that they're not going to be happy as opposed to paclitaxel trastuzumab.
So with paclitaxel and trastuzumab, of course, we perceive it to be pretty easy. But for a lot of patients, it still is, you know, it's real chemotherapy. People get neuropathy to some degree and other problems. But it's the rare patient who doesn't get through it, and a lot of people tolerate it very, very well. I find that TCHP is a pretty tough regimen. I think TCH can be a tough regimen from a sort of quality of life standpoint, and you add the P and it's that much tougher. So I think they're really quite different. Now, the question is, how different is THP and TCHP? I think there's a difference there as well. I think it's less dramatic than comparing TH alone.
So I just want to sort of take your pulse in terms of pertuzumab in the adjuvant setting and first ask you, a lot of people say they think about it very seriously in people with node-positive disease. Agree?
Agree.
What about the larger node-negative tumors?
You know, it's been a long time since I saw somebody with a big node-negative tumor that's HER2-positive. I mean, it happens. It's just not that common. I think if somebody wants to use pertuzumab in that setting, it's fine.
Well, maybe it depends on how you define big. Let's say 2.5 centimeter.
Yeah, so I don't define that as big.
How about 2.5, though?
So in somebody with a 2.5 centimeter node-negative cancer, I'm not convinced that pertuzumab adds a whole lot, if at all. Certainly the data from AFFINITY wouldn't make you think that it does, and I'm not in a rush to give those patients pertuzumab. You talk about a 4 or 5 or 6 centimeter node-negative cancer, I have a different feeling about it.
So the other question, probably the most common question we hear about this, is in the post-neoadjuvant setting, because there's so many people out there like that. What we've been hearing, it's interesting, in the non-PATH CR situation is usually pertuzumab, but in the PATH CR, we see a real split. It's almost 50-50 in investigators, whether they use it or not, with all kinds of different rationales. I think we're seeing in the community less pertuzumab with PATH CR. I don't even know what the logic is. I mean, you can make up so many different arguments, but for us, it just gets down to asking people what they do, and it seems like people are all over the place when there's a PATH CR. How do you think it through? Actually, when I interviewed Joyce, she told me she actually looks at what they started out with, like if the nodes were positive before, et cetera. But anyhow, how do you look at the PATH CR situation?
I think it's challenging because if a patient has achieved a PATH CR with a pertuzumab-based regimen, you don't know how important the pertuzumab was in achieving that PATH CR. So in that patient, I actually tend to use pertuzumab. Now, I don't treat patients with clinical stage 1 disease with neoadjuvant therapy, so I'm not in this situation where, oh, this patient might have been a candidate for TH alone. I actually am less comfortable backing off there. I do understand the rationale, and the rationale is that patients do very well after a PATH CR, and so maybe they don't need as much. But the truth is, they do well after a PATH CR because they maybe partially because they get a year of anti-HER2 therapy. So that's a group of patients where if they achieved a path CR in the stage 2 and 3 setting with a pertuzumab-based regimen, I'd continue the pertuzumab.
So let's move on, since your patient actually had metastatic disease, and get into that. But as long as we're talking about paclitaxel, again, another question I've heard from people, what about Cleopatra paclitaxel?
The best data we have from it is the Memorial Phase 2 study that was done. I actually never give docetaxel with trastuzumab and pertuzumab. I always give paclitaxel.
And with carbo?
We're talking about in the metastatic setting.
Yeah.
So, no carbo.
So then your typical first-line therapy then is paclitaxel, trastuzumab, pertuzumab.
Correct.
Interesting.
And, I really believe a taxane is a taxane in the metastatic setting.
Well, that's a good belief to have for patients, that's for sure. So one other question before we get into your case, because I see that she was ER positive, at least when she started out. In any event, kind of curious what your thoughts are about the PERTAIN study. Finally got published in the JCO. Maybe you can talk about what it looked at, what it saw, and what it means to you in terms of making decisions.
Yeah, I think the PERTAIN study is one that is a little hard to know how to apply it to clinical practice. So PERTAIN was a randomized study that looked at hormonal therapy. I believe it was an AI consistently, but I am not totally sure. And everyone received trastuzumab. This was in the metastatic setting, and half the patients received pertuzumab. And then the other wrinkle in all of this is that patients were allowed but were not required to have received a prior chemotherapy regimen. So some of these patients had received prior chemotherapy and some of them didn't. Overall, there was a benefit for pertuzumab plus trastuzumab versus trastuzumab alone. Interestingly, that benefit was predominantly in the patients who had not received prior chemotherapy. And I don't really know what to do with this, except that I think it gives one a little bit more flexibility in the patient with ER-positive, HER2-positive disease. If you really want to avoid chemotherapy and start with endocrine and anti-HER2 therapy alone, you can probably justify a little more easily than you used to be able to, giving the two antibodies and hormonal therapy. How that stacks up against giving chemotherapy first and then giving hormonal therapy, or giving hormonal therapy perhaps with just trastuzumab first, it's hard to know.
Although, in terms of tolerability, quality of life, if they use your paclitaxel, Cleopatra-type approach, it's kind of maybe a little bit easier.
Absolutely.
Wider audience there. Joyce, just spouts off stuff constantly. I was driving down US-1 the other day, listening to her interview, going, whoa, every stoplight, I'm thinking what she brought up the fact that in PERTAIN, the PFS was similar to Cleopatra. 16 months or something. And of course, obviously Cleopatra has survival data, PERTAIN doesn't, but I had never heard anybody bring that up. But whether it's comparable to Cleopatra or not, it is a pretty substantial therapy, I guess.
So I think that is the case. And, although it's confounded by the fact that some of these patients receive prior chemotherapy,
right.
As I said, I think it gives you justification if you want to use hormonal therapy and anti-HER2 therapy and you want to give two antibodies, you can do it.
So let's hear a little bit about your 56-year-old lady. I see she presented 10 years ago with locally advanced disease, gets TH followed by AC, and then develops metastatic disease 8 years after finishing trastuzumab. She's biopsies now. She's ER negative, but still HER2 positive. But she's got a PIK3 mutation, which you can take your shot at explaining what the clinical implications are. But maybe you can pick it up from there.
Sure. So when she recurred, actually, she had pretty symptomatic disease. She had big pulmonary nodules, which is really her predominant site of disease, and she was short of breath. And this is a very active woman who cycles and runs and is generally, you know, just hard to stop, and she had been stopped by this.
And she didn't have lymphangitic disease?
Nope, it was all like bulky pulmonary nodules.
How often do you see that? That just
not often. But look, it's possible there was some lymphangitic component, but we didn't see it.
That's really interesting.
She got THP, paclitaxel, trastuzumab, pertuzumab, had a great response, both symptomatically and radiographically. By the end of about 6 months, she was tired of getting paclitaxel. We continued the antibodies, and she stayed on them for 8 months and then got a little bit of disease progression. And we had a trial of HP with a PI3 kinase inhibitor, which we enrolled her on. The whole role of PIK3CA mutations and PI3 kinase inhibitors in this setting is a little bit unclear. That said, in CLEOPATRA and in other studies, PIK3CA mutations have been associated with shorter progression-free survival and a sense that the anti-HER2 therapy doesn't work quite as well in the setting of a mutation.
That's interesting because, like, when I hear PIK3, I think of ER.
So, for good reason. In ER-positive disease, 35 to 40% of tumors have PIK3CA mutations. In HER2-positive disease, it's 20% or less.
But different implications?
Maybe. And it's worth noting that in CLEOPATRA, although presence of a PIK3CA mutation was prognostic, it wasn't predictive. So it didn't change the relative benefits of pertuzumab. In any case, she went on this trial of HP plus an alpha-selective PI3 kinase inhibitor. She had stable disease for 6 months, followed by progression. I'm not sure it did a whole lot.
So before you go on, just to pick up, since you brought up these agents, anything new and exciting? Every time I hear about PI3 kinase inhibitors, I kind of haven't really heard any great clinical stuff. And I thought it was because they didn't work. And then somebody I was interviewing said, oh, no, they work fine. It's just you can't get it in them because it's too toxic. Is that the case?
Well, they're pretty toxic. They work well preclinically. In people, they don't work so great. I mean, you know, we're talking about progression-free survival improvements of a couple of months. So in the tacilizumab study that was recently reported, Sandpiper, there was a small improvement in progression-free survival. Depending on how it was analyzed, it was significant or not, but it was pretty toxic, and the decision was not to develop the drug further. It has been rumored, I think this was actually more than a rumor, I think it was in a press release, that the alpha-selective agent, which is often referred to as BYL, is superior to endocrine therapy alone. We haven't seen the results yet. The question is going to be how much superior and is it worth going further? But I think that the bottom line is, compared to where we thought we would be with these drugs, it's been a disappointment.
So this lady's disease progressed on a number of agents, including trastuzumab and pertuzumab. What are your thoughts about the novel TKI tucatinib that's shown some preliminary anti-tumor activity in patients with HER2-positive disease and progression on currently available therapies?
Yeah. So I do know a fair amount about tucatinib and am involved in the HER2CLIMB study. Tucatinib is a tyrosine kinase inhibitor that is selective for HER2, so it dials out a lot of the side effects that you see with neratinib and lapatinib, and it also has particularly favorable CNS penetration. So it's being looked at both in patients with brain mets and in patients without brain mets in a randomized trial that compares capecitabine trastuzumab with capecitabine trastuzumab tucatinib.
Any sense, based on data and your own clinical experience, in terms of the side effect profile, say, compared to, say, lapatinib?
It's a drug that's really pretty well tolerated. I mean, I don't have any direct comparative data, but my sense is that it's probably better tolerated than lapatinib. And I do want to acknowledge I'm the chair of the steering committee for the HER2CLIMB study.
So the really cool part of this thing is what comes next. When I saw this, I was like, oh, I like this.
Yeah. So she went on a trial of T-DM1 and pembrolizumab. She's had stable disease for 8 months, actually a little bit of tumor shrinkage, but not enough to call a PR. She actually tolerates this therapy beautifully. I mentioned earlier that one of my patients with leptomeningeal disease was in a fashion show last night. She was actually in the same fashion show, modeling vintage clothing.
Wow.
She also rode in our big cycling event, the Pan Mass Challenge, in August, and rode 170 miles in 2 days.
Wow.
And she's doing great. And I think this is just an example of the fact that HER2-positive disease in the metastatic setting can very much be a chronic condition these days, that the median survival is much longer than it used to be. I see no reason why this particular patient isn't going to continue to live for many more years. I mean, you know, we haven't scratched the surface of all the various chemotherapy combinations we could use. She hasn't had a TKI. You know, who knows what else is going to happen? And meanwhile, she's doing great with this combination.
So no autoimmune problems, hypothyroidism, nothing.
So she's one of the people who hasn't. And, you know, as you know, for the 70-80% of patients who tolerate these checkpoint inhibitors well, they're really easy. For the very small number who get colitis and pneumonitis and whatever else, they're horrible. And then for the patients who have the endocrinopathies, they're somewhere between horrible and okay.
So the thing that really excited me about that is, I mean, I don't have to tell you what's going on in the rest of oncology. You know, lung cancer, first-line therapy, not only of non-squamous, but now as of ASCO squamous, and maybe as of ESMO small cell, everybody's getting chemo checkpoint inhibitor.
Well, as of ESMO,
yeah,
that's also going to be true in
my next question.
All or some of patients with triple negative disease in the first line setting.
Absolutely. That was what my next question. Before we get into that, which is like super mind blowing, because finally you guys are going to get in the game for real. I just thought the idea of using an antibody drug conjugate with the checkpoint inhibitors is really cool, because it's getting the chemo thing, but without the toxicity. You wonder, maybe it could be more effective. I don't know. I've never heard anybody talk about using antibody drug conjugate and a checkpoint inhibitor. Have you had any other patients on the trial or any other data with that strategy?
So it's our trial. I don't think I've had anyone else, but we've enrolled a bunch of patients on the trial.
So, of course, that was going to be my next question, because this could be the biggest thing that happens in breast cancer this year, which is first-line therapy for metastatic triple-negative disease about to become checkpoint and chemo? And maybe you can talk about the trials that are starting to come into fruition. I think one's going to be presented right at ESMO in October.
So the trial that's being presented at ESMO is a trial that I was an investigator on, and it's nab-paclitaxel with and without atezolizumab. 900-plus patients. Patients were characterized as having tumors that were PD-L1 positive or not, using an assay that was specific to the trial. And in both the intent-to-treat patient population and in the PD-L1 positive population, there's an improvement in progression-free survival. And in the PD-L1 positive population, the initial press release was worded in a slightly less than clear manner, but it sounds as though the survival benefits that were seen were most interesting in the PD-L1 positive population. So I think what's going to be important to hear is whether this is a treatment for all patients with triple negative disease, whether it's a treatment predominantly for patients with PD-L1 positive tumors. And I think we'll just have to wait till ESMO to hear it. I am told that there is a simultaneous publication that will come out in October.
That's awesome that we'll be able to actually read about it. And do you have any sense right now about what fraction of patients would be PD-L1 positive as they defined it? Most of them or not many?
A very sizable minority.
Sizable minority.
Yeah, meaning a little less than 50%.
Now, this trial was blinded?
Yeah, so the trial was blinded, and there was essentially no unblinding.
And so I was going to ask you, if it weren't blinded, whether you had any sense that it was, you know, were you seeing greater, better responses then? But I guess you have no clue at this point in terms of the people you took care of.
Right.
And I understand there are other trials in first-line metastatic triple-negative that are close to being reported.
I'm not as familiar with those trials. The other trial that was initially submitted as a late-breaking ESMO abstract was the trial of single-agent pembro in patients who had previously been treated with chemotherapy. That was comparing pembro versus chemotherapy of physician's choice, but it was withdrawn because it didn't reach its statistical endpoints.
Do you want to sort of provide a practical summary of where we are today with single-agent checkpoint inhibitors in breast cancer, triple-negative, ER-positive, all the various subsets? And whether, you know, we're always looking for that home run or semi-home run, there's enough data to justify using it outside of trial nowadays.
Yeah. So I don't think there's a tremendous amount of activity of single-agent checkpoint inhibitors. Across all of the trials, the response rates range from a low of about 5%, this is in the triple negative setting, to a high of in the high teens. The exciting part of it is that there were literally a handful of patients in some trials who had very prolonged responses, which makes one encouraged. But I think the stronger data, although there are still relatively limited data, and this is why the ESMO presentation and the subsequent paper are going to be so important, but the stronger data are with chemotherapy.
If you do find the data from this trial compelling, will you also find it compelling to use NAB as opposed to regular paclitaxel? You know, one thing about NAB is you don't use corticosteroids. I don't know if that really means anything. Will you stick to the letter of the law, so to speak, or maybe diverge out?
I'm not sure. But the truth is that with paclitaxel, most of the time one drops the steroids after the first 2 weeks anyway. So I very much doubt that it's anything special about NAB paclitaxel. That said, particularly in the early days of using this outside of a trial, I don't really see any compelling reason not to stick to the letter of the trial. Most of the time we use paclitaxel and not NAB paclitaxel, but for the patients with first-line triple-negative disease who are getting a checkpoint inhibitor, why not do it the way the trial did it?
Just kind of curious in terms of checkpoint inhibitors in breast cancer, patient with metastatic disease who's in good condition, particularly if they're triple-negative with, you know, running out of options, or in any situation, do you do MSI testing?
So we do in-house next-generation sequencing on a large proportion of our patients with metastatic breast cancer. MSI testing as well as tumor mutational burden is part of that profile. Of course, MSI deficient status is really uncommon in breast cancer, but I have seen a couple of cases. I have yet to use a checkpoint inhibitor in those cases, not because I wouldn't, but because we just haven't gotten to that point in their disease.
So if you had a patient like that, would you, I mean, obviously you're going to have to look at a lot of other things, but would you say use it before chemo?
Well, I don't know if I'd use it before chemotherapy. I mean, it's typically, well, so if it's in the setting of triple negative disease, I would tend to use it with chemotherapy because I think we have more robust data with the atezolizumab study than anything else.
We're going to do that anyhow, even if they're MSI negative,
right,
probably. But what about everybody else? You know, you get ER positive, they run out of hormones.
Right. So in that setting, I'd probably use it. You know, whether I used it before chemotherapy or after chemotherapy would depend on the status of the patient. There were very, very, very few breast cancer patients in that cohort of individuals that led to the approval of Pembro for MSI deficient disease. And so my confidence in it as a single agent in breast cancer is still somewhat limited. So if I had a patient who was really symptomatic, I'd probably still reach for chemotherapy.
Makes sense. So the other question in terms of testing is sort of leading into your last case. And actually, I find kind of interesting answers. I figured everybody was going to say yes, but I'm not necessarily hearing an answer, including from people in your own department, which is, do you test every patient with metastatic, let's say HER2-negative disease, for BRCA? And if so, when? I figured everybody was going to say yes, and they don't necessarily say yes. Do you?
I say yes.
I would think so. Have you asked people in your own department, incidentally?
I'll have to talk to them. So in an 80-year-old woman who has no family history of breast cancer, who presented at age 75 with her initial breast cancer that's strongly ER and PR positive, maybe I wouldn't, who's not Jewish, and, you know, on and on. Look, even in patients who have a low chance of having a BRCA1 or 2 mutation, there's always a small chance. We know that mutations can occur in situations where you least expect them. And it's something we would do. In truth, because we do this next generation sequencing, we're going to find out at a tumor level if someone has a BRCA1 or 2 mutation. And we actually have a trial for patients who have somatic but no germline mutation. So in that patient who has a mutation in their tumor, we would then check to see if they have a germline mutation. If they had a germline mutation, they'd be eligible to receive a PARP inhibitor outside of a trial. If they had a somatic mutation, they'd be eligible for a trial.
Yeah, I don't have to tell you how much we talk about testing with the ovarian cancer people, including Ursula Matulonis and Joyce Liu. And there, you know, you start hearing about the strategy of actually doing somatic testing first and then reflex germline. I don't know, sure that's actually going to come into practice, but it kind of makes sense. I am curious, though, what either germline or somatic mutations that you see outside of BRCA that would get you to use a PARP inhibitor?
Well, so none outside of a trial.
Really?
But
PALB2 you wouldn't do outside a trial?
So we have a trial that's looking at it, so I would tend to enroll them in a trial. If the trial weren't available and somebody had a PALB2 mutation, I think I'd be willing to do it.
So what I really want to find out is how you integrate PARP inhibitors into the major subsets in people with BRCA germline, just to make it straightforward. I just want to ask you what happened with this lady, though. She's 40 years old, BRCA1. She starts out with locally advanced triple negative, gets ACT, a lot of residual disease, radiation. 18 months later, Mets. She goes on an investigational taxane, progresses, and then she goes on olaparib. What happened at that point? What was her condition when you started the olaparib, and what happened?
Her condition was not good, and I will tell you that this is before the approval of olaparib, and this was on a trial. And her condition was not good at all. And she had a very rapid response and a very, very deep response that lasted for a long time being over a year. And unfortunately, she developed disease progression and really didn't respond to much of anything. And that didn't surprise me given her history.
I'm guessing she got a platinum along the way.
She got a platinum, but, you know, there's certainly the suggestion that PARP inhibitors are less active in patients who have had a previous platinum, and the converse is probably the case as well. And as you know, all of the randomized trials of PARP inhibitors excluded prior platinum therapy other than treatment given in the adjuvant or neoadjuvant setting sometime in the past.
And, of course, you know, the really weird thing is in an ovary, they took a completely different strategy, give platinum after response using PARP as maintenance, standard of care, three different agents approved in that setting. Do you ever use that strategy, incidentally, platinum followed by PARP maintenance?
I haven't. And the way to address your earlier question, I tend to incorporate PARP inhibitors in patients with mutations early in the course of metastatic disease, the one exception being patients with ER and PR positive disease, where I think there's a reasonable likelihood of getting a response to endocrine therapy. I would use that first before the PARP inhibitor. I have a patient at the moment with a BRCA2 mutation who has ER positive disease, who's on a CDK4/6 inhibitor and letrozole and having a great response. But in my mind, I would give the PARP inhibitor whenever I would otherwise give initial chemotherapy.
Right. So for ER positive, that might be after CDK or maybe even beyond that. What about HER2 positive? It's not approved. Do you ever use it?
I haven't used it. We do know that HER2 positivity is less likely in the setting of BRCA1 and 2 mutations, but does occur occasionally. I think that if a patient had a BRCA1 or 2 mutation and a HER2 positive cancer, I would tend to use it at some point in time, but I wouldn't use it necessarily early on.
What about triple negative? I'm going to say somebody who presents with metastatic triple negative disease.
Well, I think you can justify using it there.
How did this lady do on the olaparib? Any side effects?
She actually had almost no side effects and did great.
No GI problems?
No.
No cytopenias? No anemia?
A little bit of cytopenias. But, I mean, she really did exceptionally well.
How many times have you used a PARP inhibitor in a breast cancer patient?
Oh, because we've had trials for a long time, I'd say probably 15 or 20 times.
I'm guessing most of that's olaparib. And what have you seen in terms of tolerability? Those problems I just mentioned, you hear about from the GYN people. What do you see?
So as single agents, I think they're pretty well tolerated. Some people have some fatigue. Some people have some cytopenias. But in general, well tolerated. Where you get into trouble, particularly with olaparib, is when you start trying to combine it with other agents.
And the last question I'll ask you is, again, we just talked about it, and I know that in ovary, I know Ursula is looking at it for sure, is checkpoint and PARP inhibitors?
We're looking at it in breast cancer, too. It's one of the trials in our SPORE grant is doing just that.
Any particular excitement about it, either theoretically or clinically?
Yeah, so there's very strong preclinical rationale. And you can argue it both ways, which is that the checkpoint inhibitor may make the PARP inhibitor work better, and the PARP inhibitor, through release of neoantigens, may make the checkpoint inhibitor work better.
I was going to ask you before when we were talking about combining chemo and a checkpoint inhibitor, the triple negative things. You know, when I ask people, does there look like, at least from the numbers, there's any synergy, like say lung cancer, where like I said, they're using it all over the place. It kind of looks more like a 1+1=2 thing. And then you're getting the checkpoint inhibitor in earlier. So now you have a chance of a home run. Maybe that's 10-20% that you're fact. But it kind of doesn't really look that synergistic. Any thoughts about whether it's going to turn out to be synergistic in breast cancer?
You know, I think it's going to be really helpful to see the results of the randomized trial and see just how good it is.